Through the Clinton years, American power became more apparent, Washington became more assertive, and foreign governments became more resistant. Some of Clinton's economic advisers, like Mickey Cantor and Lawrence Summers, were accused of arrogance in their dealings with other countries. Diplomats like Madeleine Albright and Richard Holbrook were disparaged in Europe for talking about America as, in Albright's phrase, the indispensable nation. The French foreign minister, Hubert Védrine, devised the term hyperpower, which he did not mean as a term of endearment, during the 1990s. But all these complaints were polite chatter compared with the hostility aroused by George W. Bush. For several years, the Bush administration practically boasted of its disdain for treaties, multilateral organizations, international public opinion, and anything that suggested a conciliatory approach to world politics. By Bush's second term, when the failure of this confrontational approach was clear, the administration had started to change course on many fronts, from Iraq to the Israeli-Palestinian peace process to North Korea. But the new policies were adopted belatedly, with considerable muttering and grumbling, and with elements of the administration utterly unreconciled to the new strategy. To understand the Bush administration's foreign policy, it is not enough to focus on Dick Cheney's and Donald Rumsfeld's Jacksonian impulses, or Bush's Texas background, or the nefarious neoconservative conspiracy. The crucial enabling factor for the Bush policies was 9/11. For a decade prior to the attacks, the United States had been unchecked on the world stage. But several domestic constraints, money, Congress, public opinion, made it difficult for Washington to pursue a unilateral and combative foreign policy. Military interventions and foreign aid were both unpopular, as the public wanted the United States to retreat from the world after the rigors of the Cold War. The Balkan interventions, NATO expansion, aid to Russia, all required considerable effort from the Clinton administration, often pushing uphill, despite the fact that these were relatively small ventures that cost little in resources. But 9/11 changed all that. It broke the domestic constraints on American foreign policy. After that terrible attack, Bush had a united country and a largely sympathetic world. The Afghan War heightened the aura of American omnipotence, emboldening the most hardline elements in the administration, who used that success as an argument for going to war with Iraq quickly and doing so in a particularly unilateral manner. The United States didn't need the rest of the world or the old mechanisms of legitimacy and cooperation. It was the new global empire that would create a new reality, so the argument went. The formula to explain Bush's foreign policy is simple. Unipolarity plus 9/11 plus Afghanistan equaled unilateralism plus Iraq. It was not just the substance of American policy that changed in the unipolar era, so did the style, which has become imperial and imperious. There is much communication with foreign leaders, but it is a one-way street. Other governments are often simply informed of U.S. policy. Senior American officials live in their own bubbles, rarely having any genuine interaction with their overseas counterparts, let alone other foreigners. When we meet with American officials, they talk and we listen. We rarely disagree or speak frankly because they simply can't take it in. They simply repeat the American position, like the tourist who thinks he just needs to speak louder and slower and then we will all understand, a senior foreign policy advisor in a major European government told me. Even for a senior foreign official dealing with the U.S. administration, writes the solidly pro-American Christopher Patton, recounting his experience as Europe's Commissioner for External Affairs, you are aware of your role as a tributary. However courteous your hosts, you come as a subordinate, bearing goodwill and hoping to depart with a blessing on your endeavors. In the interests of the humble leadership to which President Bush rightly aspires, it would be useful for some of his aides to try to get into their own offices for a meeting with themselves sometime, Patton continues. Attending any conference abroad, American cabinet officers arrive with the sort of entourage that would have done Darius proud. Hotels are commandeered, cities are brought to a halt, Innocent bystanders are barged into corners by thick-necked men with bits of plastic hanging out of their ears. It is not a spectacle that wins hearts and minds. President Bush's foreign trips seem designed to require as little contact as possible with the countries he visits. He is usually accompanied by 2,000 or so Americans, as well as several airplanes, helicopters, and cars. He sees little except palaces and conference rooms. His trips involve almost no effort to demonstrate respect and appreciation for the country and culture he is visiting. They also rarely involve any meetings with people outside the government, businessmen, civil society leaders, activists. Even though the president's visit must be highly programmed by definition, a broader effort to touch the people in these foreign lands would have great symbolic value. Consider an episode involving Bill Clinton and India. In May 1998, India detonated 5 underground nuclear devices. The Clinton administration roundly condemned New Delhi, levied sanctions, and indefinitely postponed a planned presidential visit. The sanctions proved painful, by some estimates costing India 1% of GDP growth over the next year. Eventually, Clinton relented and went to India in March 2000. He spent 5 days in the country, visited famous sites, put on traditional clothes, and took part in dances and ceremonies. He communicated the message that he enjoyed and admired India as a country and civilization. The result was a transformation. Clinton is a rock star in India. And George W. Bush, despite being the most pro-Indian president in American history, commands none of this attention, affection, or respect. Policy matters, but so does the symbolism surrounding it. Apart from the resentment that the imperial style produces, it ensures that American officials don't benefit from the experience and expertise of foreigners. The UN inspectors in Iraq were puzzled by how uninterested U.S. officials were in talking to them before the war. The Americans, comfortably ensconced in Washington, lectured the inspectors, who had spent weeks combing through Iraq, on the evidence of weapons of mass destruction. I thought they would be interested in our first-hand reports on what those supposedly dual-use factories looked like, one inspector told me. But no, they explained to me what those factories were being used for. To foreigners, American officials seem clueless about the world they are supposed to be running. There are 2 sets of conversations, one with Americans in the room and one without, says Kishore Mahbubani, who was formerly Singapore's foreign secretary and ambassador to the United Nations. Because Americans live in a cocoon, they don't see the sea change in attitudes toward America throughout the world. This time, it's different. It is too easy to dismiss the hostility that grew out of the Iraq campaign as just envious anti-Americanism, even if some of it is. American conservatives have claimed that there has been large popular opposition in Europe every time the United States has taken strong military action. For example, when it deployed Pershing nuclear missiles in Europe in the early 1980s. In fact, the historical record highlights the opposite. The street demonstrations and public protests against the Pershing deployments made for good television, but the reality was that in most polls, 30 to 40% of Europeans, and often more, strongly supported American policies. Even in Germany, where pacifist feelings ran sky high, 53% of the population supported the Pershing deployments, according to a 1981 poll in Der Spiegel. A majority of the French supported American policy through much of Ronald Reagan's 2 terms, even preferring him to the Democratic candidate Walter Mondale in the 1984 election. Today, in contrast, staggering majorities in most European countries, as high as 80% in many places, oppose U.S. foreign policy and even say that the United States is the greatest threat to world peace. Joseph Jaffe, one of Germany's leading international affairs commentators, observes that during the Cold War, anti-Americanism was a left-wing phenomenon. In contrast to it, there was always a center-right that was anti-communist and thus pro-American, he explains. The numbers waxed and waned, but you always had a solid base of support for the United States. In short, the Cold War kept Europe pro-American. The year 1968, for example, saw mass protests against American policies in Vietnam, but it was also the year of the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. Europeans and Asians could oppose America, but their views were balanced by wariness of the Soviet threat. Again, the polls bear this out. European opposition, even to the Vietnam War, never approached the level of the opposition to Iraq. This was true outside Europe as well. In Australia, a majority of the public supported that country's participation in the Vietnam War through 1971, when it withdrew its forces. For most of the world, the Iraq War was not about Iraq. What does Mexico or Chile care about who rules in Baghdad? Jorge Castaneda, the former foreign minister of Mexico, told me. It was about how the world's superpower wields its power. That's something we all care deeply about. Even if Iraq finally works out, that will solve only the Iraq problem. The America problem will remain. People around the globe worry about living in a world in which one country has so much power. Even if they cannot contest this power, they can complicate it. In the case of Iraq, no country could stop the United States from going to war without international sanction, but the rest of the world has made this effort more difficult by largely sitting on the sidelines in the aftermath. As of this writing, not one Arab country has opened an embassy in Baghdad. Non-Arab allies of the United States have not been much more helpful. Nicolas Sarkozy delights in being called the American and even the neoconservative in France. He is unabashedly pro-American and makes clear that he wants to emulate the United States in many ways. When he met Condoleezza Rice after his election as France's president in May 2007, she asked him, "What can I do for you?" His response was revealing. "Improve your image in the world," he said. "It's difficult when the country that is the most powerful, the most successful, that is of necessity the leader of our side, is one of the most unpopular countries in the world. It presents overwhelming problems for you and overwhelming problems for your allies. So do everything you can to improve the way you're perceived. That's what you can do for me." The neoconservative writer Robert Kagan argues that European and American differences over multilateral cooperation are a result of their relative strengths. When Europe's major countries were the world's great powers, they celebrated realpolitik and cared little for international cooperation. Since Europe is now weak, according to Kagan, it favors rules and restraints. America, for its part, wants complete freedom of action. Now that the United States is powerful, it behaves as powerful nations do. But this argument misinterprets history and misunderstands the unique place that America occupied in 20th century diplomacy. America was the most powerful country in the world when it proposed the creation of the League of Nations to manage international relations after World War I. It was the dominant power at the end of World War II, when it founded the United Nations, created the Bretton Woods system of international economic cooperation, and launched the world's key international organizations. America had the world at its feet, but Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Harry Truman chose not to create an American imperium. Instead, they built an international order of alliances and multilateral institutions, and helped get the rest of the world back on its feet by pumping out vast amounts of aid and private investment. The centerpiece of this effort, the Marshall Plan, was worth $100 billion in today's dollars. For most of the 20th century, in other words, America embraced international cooperation not out of fear and vulnerability, but out of confidence and strength. Central to this approach was the special attention given to diplomacy. Think of what it must have meant for Franklin Roosevelt, at the pinnacle of power, to go halfway around the world, to Tehran and Yalta, to meet with Churchill and Stalin in 1943 and 1945. Roosevelt was a sick man, paralyzed from the waist down, hauling 10 pounds of steel braces on his legs. Traveling for 40 hours by sea and air took the life out of him. He did not have to go. He had plenty of deputies, George Marshall, Dwight Eisenhower, who could have done the job. Or he could have summoned the other leaders to him. But FDR understood that American power had to be coupled with the generosity of spirit. he insisted that British commanders like Montgomery be given their fair share of glory in the war. He brought China into the UN Security Council, even though it was a poor peasant society, because he believed it was important to have the largest Asian country properly represented within a world body. The standard set by Roosevelt and his generation endured. When Secretary of State Marshall devised the plan that bears his name, he insisted that the initiative and control lie with Europeans. For decades thereafter, the United States built dams, funded magazines, and provided technical know-how to other countries. It sent its scholars and students abroad so that people got to know America and Americans. It paid deference to its allies, even when they were in no sense equals. It conducted joint military exercises with small nations, even when they added little to U.S. readiness. For half a century, American presidents and secretaries of state circled the globe and hosted their counterparts in a never-ending cycle of diplomacy. All these exertions served our interests, of course. They produced a pro-American world that was rich and secure. They laid the foundations for a booming global economy in which others could participate and in which America thrived. But it was an enlightened self-interest that took into account the interests of others. Above all, it reassured countries, through word and deed, style and substance, that America's mammoth power was not to be feared. New rules for a new age. Some Americans believe that we should not learn from history, but just copy it. If only we could find another Truman administration, many liberals and Democrats seem to pine, it would establish a new set of institutions for a new era. But this is nostalgia, not strategy. When Truman, Acheson, and Marshall built the post-war order, the rest of the world was in tatters. People had seen the devastating effects of nationalism, war, and economic protectionism. As a result, there was strong support everywhere, especially in the United States, for a large and generous effort to engage the world, raise it out of poverty, create global institutions, and ensure international cooperation, so that such a war never took place again. America had the moral high ground that came from defeating fascism, but it also had unrivaled power. American GDP made up almost 50% of the global economy. Outside of the Soviet sphere, Washington's lead role in devising new institutions was never really questioned. Today, the world is different, and so is America's position in it. Were Truman and Marshall and Acheson alive, they would face a wholly new set of challenges. The task for today is to construct a new approach for a new era, one that responds to a global system in which power is far more diffuse than ever before, and in which everyone feels empowered. The United States does not have the hand it had in 1945 or even in 2000. Still, it does have a stronger hand than anyone else, the most complete portfolio of economic, political, military, and cultural power, and it will not be replaced in the foreseeable future. Perhaps more importantly, we do not need to invent the world anew. The international order established by the United States after World War II is in urgent need of expansion and repair, but not reconception. As the Princeton scholar John Eikenberry has perceptively noted, the Western-oriented system created in the 1940s and 1950s allows for the expansion of global trade, the rise of new powers, and mechanisms of cooperation and conflict management. It cannot always and easily address certain problems, such as great power conflict and internal human rights tragedies, but those are the limits of international relations, not of these particular structures. Simultaneously, the reality of nuclear weapons and deterrence makes it extremely costly, suicidal, for a rising power to try to assert itself militarily against its peers. Today's Western order, in short, is hard to overturn and easy to join, writes Eikenberry. That is how modern Japan and Germany have seen their choices, and how China and India seem to be viewing their future. They want to gain power and status and respect for sure, but by growing within the international system, not by overturning it. As long as these new countries feel that they can be accommodated, they have every incentive to become responsible stakeholders in the system. The rise of the rest, while real, is a long, slow process, and it is one that ensures America a vital, though different, role. As China, India, Brazil, Russia, South Africa, and a host of smaller countries all do well in the years ahead, new points of tension will emerge among them. Many of these rising countries have historical animosities, border disputes, and contemporary quarrels with one another. In most cases, nationalism will grow along with economic and geopolitical stature. Being a distant power, America is often a convenient partner for many regional nations worried about the rise of a hegemon in their midst. In fact, as the scholar William Wolforth notes, American influence is strengthened by the growth of a dominant regional power. These factors are often noted in discussions of Asia, but it is true of many other spots on the globe as well. The process will not be mechanical. As one of these countries rises, China, it will not produce a clockwork-like balancing dynamic where its neighbor, India, will seek a formal alliance with the United States. Today's world is more complicated than that. But these rivalries do give the United States an opportunity to play a large and constructive role at the center of the global order. It has the potential to be what Bismarck helped Germany become briefly in the late 19th century, Europe's honest broker, forging close relationships with each of the major countries, ties that were closer than the ones those countries had with one another. It was the hub of the European system. Being the global broker today would be a job involving not just the American government, but its society, with all the strengths and perspectives that it will bring to the challenge. It is a role that the United States, with its global interests and presence, complete portfolio of power, and diverse immigrant communities, could learn to play with great skill. This new role is quite different from the traditional superpower role. It involves consultation, cooperation, and even compromise. It derives its power by setting the agenda, defining the issues, and mobilizing coalitions. It is not a top-down hierarchy in which the United States makes its decisions and then informs a grateful or silent world. But it is a crucial role, because in a world with many players, setting the agenda and organizing coalitions become primary forms of power. The chair of the board, who can gently guide a group of independent directors, is still a very powerful person. Those who have figured out how best to thrive in a post-American world are America's great multinationals. They are conquering new markets by changing their old ways. Take General Electric, which in the past didn't believe in joint ventures abroad. It wanted to own 100% of every foreign involvement it had. Over the last 5 years, however, as it has watched the growing skill and confidence of the local firms in emerging markets like China, India, Brazil, Russia, and South Africa, GE has come to realize that such a strategy would keep it locked out of the fastest-growing parts of the world. So it changed its approach. GE's CEO, Jeffrey Immelt, sums it up. "Sure, we could keep buying small companies and GE-izing them, but we've learned that it's better to partner with the number three company that wants to be number one than to buy a tiny company or go it alone." The New York Times called it a turn away from managerial imperialism, which has become a luxury GE could no longer afford. Washington, which faces no market test, has not yet figured out that diplomatic imperialism is a luxury that the United States can no longer afford. There is still a strong market for American power, for both geopolitical and economic reasons. But even more centrally, there remains a strong ideological demand for it. No one in Asia wants to live in a Chinese-dominated world. "There is no Chinese dream to which people aspire," explained Simon Tay, a Singaporean scholar. A former president of Brazil, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, has argued that what the world really wants from America is not that it offer a concession on trade here and there, but that it affirm its own ideals. That role, as the country that will define universal ideals, remains one that only America can play. America's soft power, in this sense, is intricately linked to its hard power, but it is the combination of the two that give it a unique role in world affairs. To describe more concretely what operating in this new world would look like, I have set out 6 simple guidelines. Number 1. Choose. American omnipotence has made Washington believe that it is exempt from the need to have priorities. It wants to have it all. It is crucial that the United States be more disciplined about this. On North Korea and Iran, for example, the Bush administration could not decide whether it wanted regime change or policy change, that is, denuclearization. The two work at cross purposes. If you threaten a country with regime change, it only makes more urgent that government's desire for nuclear weapons, which is an insurance policy in the world of international politics. Consider what the world looks like to Iran. It is surrounded by nuclear powers, Russia, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, and across 2 of its borders sit tens of thousands of U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. The President of the United States has repeatedly made clear that he regards the regime in Tehran as illegitimate, wishes to overthrow it, and funds various groups whose aims are similar. If you were in Tehran, would this make you feel like giving up your nuclear program? Insisting on both policy change and regime change, we have gotten neither. Or take American policy toward Russia. We have never been able to prioritize what exactly our core interests and concerns with Moscow are. Is it the danger of its loose nuclear weapons, which can be secured only with its help? Is it Moscow's help in isolating Iran, or its behavior in Ukraine and Georgia, or its opposition to the proposed missile shield in Eastern Europe, or its oil and natural gas policies, or internal human rights conditions in Russia? Recent U.S. policy has been all of the above. But to govern is to choose. If we believe that nuclear proliferation and terrorism are the gravest issues we face at present, as President Bush has said, then securing Russia's nuclear arsenal and preventing Iran from developing nuclear weapons are surely the 2 issues on which we should be seeking Russian cooperation above all else. The United States will especially need to choose with regard to China. China is experiencing the largest, swiftest rise to world power of any country in history, larger and swifter even than that of the United States in the past. It will have to be given some substantial political and even military space commensurate with that power. At the same time, its rise should not become a cover for expansionism, aggression, or disruption. How to strike this balance, deterring China on the one hand, accommodating its legitimate growth on the other, is the central strategic challenge for American diplomacy. The United States can and should draw lines with China, but it should also recognize that it cannot draw lines everywhere. Unfortunately, the most significant hurdle the United States faces in shaping such a policy is a domestic political climate that tends to view any concessions and accommodations as appeasement. To the extent that the United States can learn something from the experience of Great Britain, it is the need to make large strategic choices about where it will focus its energies and attention. Britain did so wisely when it faced the rise of the United States. It was less wise about its own empire. In the early 20th century, London confronted a dilemma much like Washington's today. When a crisis broke out somewhere, no matter how remote, the world would look to London and ask, "What will you do about this?" Britain's strategic blunder was to spend decades, time and money, energy and attention, on vain attempts to stabilize peripheral places on the map. For example, Britain should have expended less effort organizing the constitutional arrangements of Dutch farmers in the Transvaal, and thus fighting the Boer War, which broke the back of the empire, and more facing up to its declining productivity and the rise of Germany in the center of Europe. British elites pored over Roman histories, in part because of their fascination with the previous great empire, but also because they were looking for lessons in managing vast swaths of land on different continents. There was a demand, as it were, for people skilled in language, history, and imperial administration. This, however, ended up trumping the need to develop the engineers of the future. Britain's power and reach also made it intoxicated with a sense of historic destiny, a trend fueled by a Protestant revival. The historian Corelli Barnett wrote in the 1970s that a moral revolution gripped England in the mid-19th century, moving it away from the practical and reason-based society that had brought about the Industrial Revolution and toward one dominated by religious evangelicalism, excessive moralism, and romanticism. The United States could easily fall into a similar imperial trap. Every crisis around the world demands its attention and action. American tentacles and interests are spread as widely today as were Britain's at the height of its empire. For those who believe that America's place in the world is wholly different from that of the British Empire, it is instructive to read the Base Structure Report for the fiscal year 2006. In it, the Department of Defense boasts of being one of the world's largest landlords, with a physical plant consisting of more than 571,200 facilities, buildings, structure, and utilities, located on more than 3,700 sites on nearly 30 million acres. The report lists a sprawling network of 766 bases in 40 foreign countries, from Antigua to the United Kingdom. These overseas bases were worth at least $127 billion in 2005, housed 197,000 uniformed personnel, and had an equal number of dependents and civilian officials, and employed an additional 81,000 local hires. They covered 687,000 acres, nearly 1,100 square miles, of foreign land, and cost taxpayers $13 billion in maintenance alone. America may be more powerful than Britain was, but it still cannot neglect the lesson that it must make choices. It cannot be involved in everything. Tensions in the Middle East are important, but they have sucked all the resources, energy, and attention out of every other issue in American foreign policy for the last 7 years. Washington has to move out of the 8th century AD, adjudicating claims between Sunnis and Shias in Baghdad, and move into the 21st century, to China, India, Brazil, where the future is being made. Every choice to engage in some cause, worthy as it is a distraction from the larger strategic issues that confront the United States. In focusing on the seemingly urgent, we will forget the truly important. Number 2. Build broad rules, not narrow interests. There is a fundamental tension in U.S. foreign policy. Does the country want to push its own particular interests abroad, or does it want to create a structure of rules, practices, and values by which the world will be bound? In an age of rising new powers, the United States' overriding goal should be the latter, so that even as these countries get more powerful, they will continue to live within the framework of the current international system. This is the principal constraint we can construct to ensure that the rise of the rest does not turn into a downward competitive spiral, with great powers freelancing for their own interests and advantage in such a way as to destabilize the whole system. For such a system to work, we would have to adhere to these rules as well. If the United States freelances when it suits its purposes, why would China not do the same with regard to Taiwan, or India with regard to Pakistan? If we are not bound by the rules, why should they be? First, that means recommitting itself to the institutions and mechanisms for problem-solving and adjudication that the United States largely created over the last 5 decades. But this is more than simply about attending more UN meetings and signing treaties. When the United States proclaims universal values, it must phrase its positions carefully. George Bush declared in his second inaugural that it is the policy of the United States to seek and support the growth of democratic movements and institutions in every nation and culture with the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world. And yet, when Democrats in Taiwan and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia were silenced, the United States kept quiet, arguing, perhaps persuasively, that these are special cases. Still, Washington pillories China and scolds India for not being tougher on North Korea and Burma. Diplomats in both countries will tell you that these are special cases for them. Instability in Burma is a remote problem for the United States, but that country shares long borders with China and India. Instability to them means millions of refugees. Washington should recognize that if it has its own exceptions, so do other countries, or else it should drop its own exceptions. But to do neither and preach one thing and practice another is hypocrisy, which is both ineffective and undermining of American credibility. When it comes to terrorism, the United States has been too narrow-minded. The best systemic protection against the threat of terrorism would be a global set of customs and immigration controls that checks people and cargo around the world using the same standards and sharing databases. As it is now, America's unilateral approach forces countries and airlines to comply, but only at its own borders, creating choke points with negative consequences for the economy and for America's image in the world. That's why, in the midst of a worldwide tourism boom, travel to the United States has been sluggish ever since 9/11. The more significant ongoing example of this tension has to do with nuclear proliferation. The United States asks the rest of the world to strictly adhere to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The treaty has created a two-tier system. Those nations that developed nuclear weapons before 1968 are permitted to have them. Those that didn't are not, and must accordingly follow certain guidelines for developing nuclear energy. But even while insisting that non-nuclear powers comply, the United States and other nuclear powers have themselves taken no steps to follow the other injunction in the treaty, to pursue negotiations in good faith on effective measures relating to the cessation of the nuclear arms race and to nuclear disarmament. Thus, when the United States tells countries that to build a single nuclear weapon is a moral, political, and strategic abomination, while maintaining an arsenal of thousands of missiles and building and testing new ones, the condemnation rings hollow. Motivated by such concerns, Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, William Perry, and Sam Nunn have proposed that the United States lead an ambitious effort among the nuclear powers, and particularly with Russia, which together with America holds 85% of all nuclear weapons, to reduce the numbers of weapons, move them off alert status, and eventually work toward a non-nuclear world. Whether or not we get all the way there, and whether or not a world without nuclear deterrence is a good idea, the United States would gain much credibility if it made some serious efforts in this direction. Or else, once again, it appears to be saying to the rest of the world, "Do what I say, not what I do." Rule number 3. Be Bismarck, not Britain. Joseph Joffe has argued that there are two historical analogies that the United States could look to in constructing its grand strategy: Britain and Bismarck. Britain tried to balance against rising and threatening great powers, but otherwise kept a low profile on the European continent. Bismarck, by contrast, chose to engage with all the great powers. His goal was to have better relations with all of them than any of them had with each other, to be the pivot of Europe's international system. For the United States, the British option is not the right one. America has played that role in the past, against Nazi Germany and Soviet Russia. But the circumstances today make such a strategy unwise. The world is not divided into camps, and it is far more connected and interdependent than it was. Balancing against a rising power would be a dangerous, destabilizing, and potentially self-fulfilling policy. Were Washington to balance against China, before Beijing has shown any serious inclination to disrupt the international order, it would find itself isolated and would pay heavy costs economically and politically for itself being the disruptive force. Given America's massive power, not overplaying its hand must be a crucial component of any grand strategy. Otherwise, others will try, in various ways, to balance against it. Washington is, however, ideally suited to play a Bismarckian role in the current global system. It has better relations with almost all the major powers than they do with each other. In Asia, the Bush administration has done an excellent job of strengthening ties with Japan, Australia, and India. It should try to do the same with Russia and China. While Washington has many differences with Moscow and Beijing, there is no advantage to turning them into permanent adversaries. The virtue of the Bismarckian approach is that it gives the United States the greatest leverage with all parties, maximizing its ability to shape a peaceful and stable world. And if things do not work out, it also gives the United States legitimacy and leeway to move into a balancing role. Rule number 4. Order à la carte. Among scholars and practitioners of international relations, there is one predominant theory about how and why international peace endures. It holds that the most stable system is one with a single dominant power that maintains order. Britain and the United States have played this role for 200 years. In each case, the hegemon was the dominant economic and military player, becoming the market and lender of last resort, home to the world financial center, and holder of the reserve currency. In political-military terms, each secured the sea lanes, balanced against rising threats, and intervened when it thought necessary to prevent disorder. Although both made many mistakes, the stability of the system and the success of the world economy and the open societies it created are an extraordinary legacy of Anglo-American hegemony. What if that hegemony is waning? America no longer has the only large market in the world. The dollar is unlikely to retain its totemic position forever as the reserve currency, yielding to a basket that is largely composed of euros and dollars, but includes other currencies too. In certain areas, the South China Sea, for example, U.S. military force is likely to be less relevant than that of China. In international negotiations, America will have to bargain and compromise with others. Does all this add up to instability and disorder? Not necessarily. 200 years of Anglo-American hegemony has in fact created a system that is not as fragile as it might have been in the 1920s and 1930s, when British power waned, America was unwilling to step in, and Europe fell through the cracks. The basic conception of the current system, an open world economy, multilateral negotiations, has wide acceptance, and new forms of cooperation are growing. Anne-Marie Slaughter has written about how legal systems are constructing a set of transnational standards without anyone forcing them to do so, creating a bottom-up networked order. Not every issue will lend itself to such stabilization, but many will. In other words, the search for a superpower solution to every problem may be futile and unnecessary. Smaller workarounds might be just as effective. The United States should embrace such ad hoc order. Richard Huss, the former head of policy planning at the State Department, has creatively called for a la carte multilateralism. No one institution or organization is always right, no one framework ideal. The UN might work for one problem, NATO for another, the OAS for a third. And for a new issue like climate change, perhaps a new coalition that involves private business and non-governmental groups would make the most sense. International life is only going to get messier. Being accommodating, flexible, and adaptable is likely to produce better results on the ground than insisting on a pure approach based on the notion that the only way to solve international problems is the way we have solved international problems in the past, in decades when the state was unusually strong. A more organic international system, in which problems are addressed through a variety of different structures and solutions, can create its own kind of layered stability. It is not as appealing as a more formal structure of peace, rooted in and directed through one or two central organizations in New York and Geneva, but it might be a more realistic and durable order. The search for order is not simply an American problem. If the rise of the rest also brings about a rise in national pride and interest and assertiveness, it has the potential to produce disorder everywhere. At the same time, this rise is happening in a world in which peace and stability pay great rewards, giving China, India, and even Russia large incentives to keep the system stable. The problem is that these rising powers do not have an obvious and immediate incentive to solve the common problems that this new system generates. National frictions, climate change, trade disputes, environmental degradation, and infectious disease might all fester until a crisis hits, and then it might be too late. Solving such problems and providing global public goods requires a moderator, organizer, or leader. Rule number 5. Think asymmetrically. The United States has the most powerful military in the history of the world, and yet it has found it difficult to prevail in Iraq. The Israeli military is vastly superior to Hezbollah's forces, but it was not able to win a decisive victory over the latter in its conflict with it. Why? Because the current era is one in which asymmetrical responses have become easier to execute and difficult to defeat. This is true not simply in war. Consider the rise of drug cartels, money laundering syndicates, migrant workers, and terrorists, all far smaller and poorer than the governments that oppose them. In an age of constant activity across and within borders, small groups of people with ingenuity, passion, and determination have important advantages. In working within this context, the first and most important lesson is not to get drawn into traps. In a videotaped message in 2004, Osama bin Laden explained his strategy with astonishing frankness. He termed it provoke and bait. All we have to do is send two mujahideen and raise a piece of cloth on which it is written Al-Qaeda in order to make the generals race there to cause America to suffer human, economic, and political losses. His point has been well understood by ragtag terror groups across the world. With no apparent communication, collaboration, or further guidance from bin Laden, small outfits from Southeast Asia to North Africa to Europe now announce that they are part of Al-Qaeda and so inflate their own importance, bring global attention to their cause, and of course, get America to come racing out to fight them. This kind of overreaction also makes the U.S. military presence and policies, its bombings, its collateral damage, the main issue. The local debate moves from terrorism to U.S. imperialism. Consider the manner in which the United States is considering expanding its presence in Africa. The rhetoric that the Bush administration has used is commendable. We want to prevent problems from becoming crises and crises from becoming catastrophes, Teresa Whelan, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for African Affairs, explained in an interview in 2007. We have in our national interest that Africa is a stable continent. Its solution, however, has been the creation of a new military command for the continent, AFRICOM, with its own commander and staff. But as the Washington Post columnist David Ignatius perceptively asks, is the U.S. military the right instrument for the nation-building effort that AFRICOM apparently envisions? Will a larger U.S. military presence check terrorism and instability on the continent, or will it instead become a new magnet for anti-Americanism? The United States has many interests in Africa, from keeping countries stable to checking China's influence to preventing humanitarian tragedies. But is a military command the way to go about this? Or is this simply the response generated because this is how the U.S. government knows to respond, with a military command? The danger here is of wasted resources, a reaction to perceived American imperialism, but the deeper problem is conceptual. It is a misdiagnosis of the problem. To the man who has a hammer, Mark Twain wrote, "Every problem looks like a nail." The United States should be thinking creatively and asymmetrically. This would allow it to capitalize on one of its key advantages. The United States has a much broader and deeper range of instruments than just its military. An American policy toward Africa, for example, that focused on building up our diplomatic corps, nation-building capacities, and technical assistance teams would be a bit duller than AFRICOM, but it might be more effective in the long run. This would be true outside Africa as well. What the United States is lacking in a place like Pakistan is a broader effort to assist that country in its modernization, and an effort that makes it clear that the United States wants to ally with the people of that country and not merely its military. When I was growing up in India, the U.S. Information Services used to serve as ambassadors of American culture, ideas, and ideals. That entire approach to diplomacy was shuttered after the Cold War, and even after 9/11 remains moribund. The U.S. military effort against Islamic extremism has received close to $1 trillion of funding. The generous accounting of the figures for diplomatic and civilian activities would be under $10 billion. America is also much more than its government. And here there is more promising activity. Foundations, universities, charities, and private individuals are working more deeply and effectively abroad. Washington should learn more from these groups, work more with them, and engage other Americans to get involved. American Muslims, instead of being questioned, harassed, and detained, should be enlisted in the effort to understand the appeal of Islamic fundamentalism. One of America's core strengths, its civil society, has been largely untapped in the war on terror. Rule number 6. Legitimacy is power. The United States has every kind of power in ample supply these days, except one: legitimacy. In today's world, this is a critical deficiency. Legitimacy allows one to set the agenda, define a crisis, and mobilize support for policies among both countries and non-governmental forces like private business and grassroots organizations. Legitimacy was what allowed the rock singer Bono, for example, to change government policy on a crucial issue, debt relief. His power lay in his ability to capture the intellectual and moral high ground. Legitimacy comes in many forms. The Clinton administration used force on 3 important occasions in Bosnia, Haiti, and Kosovo. In none of them did it take the matter to the UN Security Council, but there was little suggestion that it needed to do so. Indeed, Secretary General Kofi Annan even made statements that seemed to justify the action in Kosovo, explaining that state sovereignty should not be used as a cover for humanitarian abuses. The Clinton administration was able to get away with this partly because of a basic sense of trust. While the Clinton administration, or the George H.W. Bush administration, was assertive in many ways, the rest of the world did not need assurances about its intentions. The current Bush administration does not bear all the blame for how dramatic the difference is today. Because of 9/11, it had no choice but to assert American power and act forcefully on the world stage, but that should have given it all the more reason to adopt a posture of consultation and cooperation while doing what needed to be done. It's one thing to scare your enemies, it's another to terrify the rest of the world. The United States retains considerable ability to set the agenda and thereby confer legitimacy with regard to what constitutes a problem, crisis, or outrage. American ideas and ideals still dominate the debates over Darfur, Iranian nuclear weapons, and Burma. But Washington needs to understand that generating international public support for its view of the world is a core element of power, not merely an exercise in public relations. Other countries, peoples, and groups now have access to their own narratives and networks. They will not quietly accept the version of events handed down to them. Washington will have to make its case, and persuasively. This task has gotten more difficult, but it has also become more vital. In an increasingly empowered and democratized world, in the long run, the battle of ideas is close to everything. The Bush administration never seemed to understand the practical value of legitimacy in the run-up to the Iraq War. American officials would contest the view that they were isolated by pointing to their allies in New Europe, Asia, and Africa, many of whom were bribed or cajoled into the coalition. And while the governments of Central Europe supported Washington, its people opposed it in almost the same numbers as in old Europe. Missing this distinction, Washington misunderstood Turkey, a long-standing and faithful ally that had become much more democratic over the 1990s. The government wanted to back the United States, but more than 90% of the Turkish people opposed it. The result, after a close parliamentary vote, was that Turkey could not support the United States, which meant the two-front war against Saddam Hussein became a one-front war with serious drawbacks. At the start of the war, the United States had the support of a majority of the people in only one country in the world, Israel. And while one might laud Tony Blair for his loyalty, one cannot expect most democratic politicians to ignore the wishes of vast majorities of their people. Nationalism in a unipolar world can often become anti-American. How do you show that you are a staunch Brazilian, Chinese, or Russian patriot? By standing up to Mr. Big. In the 1970s, many of Indira Gandhi's domestic policies were unpopular. Standing up to America, however, would always get a cheer on the campaign trail. Why? India was then, as now, fascinated by America and the American dream. But it was a sign of strength and courage that Mrs. Gandhi could assert herself against the hegemon. Americans complain that this is irrational and that the country is unfairly turned into a punching bag. They are right. But get over it. There are many, many advantages to being a superpower. It has some costs as well. Those costs can be easily lowered by attentive diplomacy. It is better to be feared than loved, Machiavelli wrote. It is a motto that Dick Cheney takes to heart. In a 2007 speech, he quoted Bernard Lewis to the effect that during the Cold War, Middle Eastern dictators learned that they should fear the Soviet Union, but not America. Machiavelli and Cheney are wrong. Yes, the Soviet Union was feared by its allies, while the United States was loved, or at least liked. Look who's still around. It is odd and unsettling that Vice President Cheney should cite enviously the thuggish and failed strategies of a totalitarian dictatorship. America has transformed the world with its power, but also with its ideals. When China's pro-democracy protesters gathered in Tiananmen Square, they built a makeshift figure that suggested the Statue of Liberty, not an F-16. America's image may not be as benign as Americans think, but it is, in the end, better than the alternatives. That is what has made its immense power tolerable to the world for so long. Fear and loathing. Before it can implement any of these specific strategies, however, the United States must make a much broader adjustment. It needs to stop cowering in fear. It is fear that has created a climate of paranoia and panic in the United States, and fear that has enabled our strategic missteps. Having spooked ourselves into believing that we have no option but to act fast and alone, preemptively and unilaterally, we have managed to destroy decades of international goodwill, alienate allies, and embolden enemies, while solving few of the major international problems we face. To recover its place in the world, America first has to recover its confidence. By almost all objective measures, the United States is in a blessed position today. It faces problems, crises, and resistance, but compared with any of the massive threats of the past, Nazi Germany, Stalin's aggression, nuclear war, the circumstances are favorable and the world is moving our way. In 1933, Franklin Delano Roosevelt diagnosed the real danger for the United States. "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," he said. "Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror." And he was arguing against fear when America's economic and political system was near collapse, when a quarter of the workforce was unemployed, and when fascism was on the march around the world. Somehow we have managed to spook ourselves in a time of worldwide peace and prosperity. Keeping that front and center in our minds is crucial to ensure that we do not miscalculate, misjudge, and misunderstand. America has become a nation consumed by anxiety, worried about terrorists and rogue nations, Muslims and Mexicans, foreign companies and free trade, immigrants and international organizations. The strongest nation in the history of the world now sees itself as besieged by forces beyond its control. While the Bush administration has contributed mightily to the state of affairs, it is a phenomenon that goes beyond one president. Too many Americans have been taken in by a rhetoric of fear. The 2008 presidential campaign could have provided the opportunity for a national discussion of the new world we live in. On the Republican side, it has been largely an exercise in chest-thumping hysteria. The contenders may have left the scene, but their words both reflect and shape the national consciousness. "They hate you," Rudy Giuliani repeatedly shouted on the campaign trail, relentlessly reminding audiences of the nasty people out there. "They don't want you to be in this college," he warned an audience at Oglethorpe University in Atlanta. "Or you, or you, or you," he added, reportedly jabbing his finger at students. Giuliani urged that America not only stay on the offensive, but go on the offensive on new fronts. In his book, Courage Matters, Senator John McCain took a far more sensible approach and wrote, "Get on the damn elevator, fly on the damn plane, calculate the odds of being harmed by a terrorist. It's still about as likely as being swept out to sea by a tidal wave." Writing in late 2003, he added what seemed like a sound rule of thumb. "Watch the terrorist alert and when it falls below yellow, go outside again. Unfortunately, since 9/11, the alert has never dropped below yellow, which means an elevated level of risk from a terrorist attack. At airports, it has almost permanently been at orange, high risk, the second highest level of alertness. Yet the Department of Homeland Security admits that there continues to be no credible information at this time warning of an imminent threat to the homeland. Since 9/11, only 2 or 3 extremely minor terrorist plots have been uncovered in the entire country, and there's no example of an Al-Qaeda sleeper cell having been found in America. And still, the enemy, as many American politicians describe it, is vast, global, and relentless. Giuliani casually lumped together Iran and Al-Qaeda. Mitt Romney went further, banding together all the supposed bad guys. This is about Shia and Sunni. This is about Hezbollah and Hamas and Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood, he recently declared. In fact, Iran is a Shiite power and actually helped the United States topple the Al-Qaeda-backed Taliban regime in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda-affiliated radical Sunnis slaughtered Shiites in Iraq, and Iranian-backed Shiite militias responded by executing Iraqi Sunnis. We are now repeating one of the central errors of the early Cold War, putting together all our potential adversaries rather than dividing them. Mao and Stalin were both nasty, but they were nasties who disliked each other, a fact that could be exploited to the great benefit of the free world. To miss this is not strength, it's stupidity. The competition to be the tough guy has produced new policy ideas, ones that range from bad to insane. Romney, who bills himself as a smart, worldly manager, recently explained that while some people have said we ought to close Guantanamo, my view is we ought to double the size of Guantanamo. Romney asked in 2005, are we monitoring mosques? Are we wiretapping? Of course, this proposal is mild compared with what Representative Tom Tancredo, another Republican presidential candidate, suggested the same year. When asked about a possible nuclear strike by Islamic radicals on the United States, he suggested that the U.S. military threaten to take out Mecca. Some praise the Bush administration's aggressive approach for preventing another terrorist attack on U.S. soil after 9/11. Certainly, the administration does deserve credit for dismantling Al-Qaeda's infrastructure in Afghanistan and in other countries where it once had branches or supporters, though that success has been more limited than many recognize. But since 9/11, there have occurred terrorist attacks in countries like Britain, Spain, Morocco, Turkey, Indonesia, and Saudi Arabia, most of which are also very tough on terrorism. The common thread in these attacks is that they were launched by local groups. It's easier to spot and stop foreign agents, far more difficult to detect a group of locals. The crucial advantage that the United States has in this regard is that it does not have a radicalized domestic population. American Muslims are generally middle class, moderate, and well assimilated. They believe in America and the American dream. The first comprehensive poll of U.S. Muslims, conducted in 2007 by the Pew Research Center, found that more than 70% believed that if you work hard in America, you get ahead. That figure for the general U.S. population is only 64%. Their responses to almost all questions were in the American mainstream, and strikingly different from the responses of Muslim populations elsewhere. Some 13% of U.S. Muslims believe that suicide bombing can be justified. Too high for sure, but the figure compares with 42% for French Muslims and 88% for Jordanians. This distinct American advantage, testament to the country's ability to assimilate new immigrants, is increasingly in jeopardy. If American leaders begin insinuating that the entire Muslim population be viewed with suspicion, that will change the community's relationship to the United States. Proposals by presidential candidates of wiretapping America's mosques and bombing Mecca are certainly not steps in the right direction. Though Democrats are more sensible on most of these issues, the party remains consumed by the fear that it will not come across as tough. Its presidential candidates vie with one another to prove that they are going to be just as macho and militant as the fiercest Republican. In a South Carolina presidential debate in 2007, when candidates were asked how they would respond to another terror strike, they promptly vowed to attack, retaliate, and blast the hell out of, well, somebody. Barack Obama, the only one to answer differently, quickly realized his political vulnerability and dutifully threatened retaliation as well. After the debate, his opponent suggested that his original response proved he didn't have the fortitude to be president. In fact, Obama's initial response was the right one. He said that the first thing he would do was to make certain that the emergency response was effective, then ensure we had the best intelligence possible to figure out who had caused the attack, and then move with allies to dismantle the network responsible. We will never be able to prevent a small group of misfits from planning some terrible act of terror. No matter how far-seeing and competent our intelligence and law enforcement officials, people will always be able to slip through the cracks in a large, open, and diverse country. The real test of American leadership is not whether we can make 100% sure we will prevent the attack, but rather how we respond to it. Stephen Flynn, a Homeland Security expert at the Council on Foreign Relations, argues that our goal must be resilience. How quickly can we bounce back from a disruption? In the material sciences, resilience is the ability of a material to recover its original shape after a deformation. If one day bombs do go off, we must ensure that they cause as little disruption, economic, social, political, as possible. This would prevent the terrorist from achieving his main objective. If we are not terrorized, then in a crucial sense, we have defeated terrorism. The atmosphere of fear and panic we are currently engendering is likely to produce the opposite effect. Were there to be another attack, two things can be predicted with near certainty. The actual effects of the attack would be limited, allowing the country to get back to normal quickly, and Washington would go berserk. Politicians would fall over each other to pledge to pulverize, annihilate, and destroy someone. A retaliatory strike would be appropriate and important if you could hit the right targets. But what if the culprits were based in Hamburg, or Madrid, or Trenton? It is far more likely that a future attack will come from countries that are unknowingly and involuntarily sheltering terrorists. Are we going to bomb Britain and Spain because they housed a terrorist cell? The other likely effect of another terror attack would be an increase in the restrictions on movement, privacy, and civil liberties that have already imposed huge economic, political, and moral costs on America. The process of screening passengers at airports, which costs nearly $5 billion annually, gets more cumbersome every year as new potential risks are discovered. The visa system, which has become restrictive and forbidding, will get more so every time one thug is let in. None of these procedures is designed with any consideration of striking a balance between the need for security and the need for openness and hospitality. The incentives are skewed to ensure that anytime, anywhere an official has a concern, he is better off stopping, questioning, arresting, and deporting. Our fears extend well beyond terrorism. CNN's Lou Dobbs has become the spokesman of a paranoid and angry segment of the country, railing against the sinister forces that are overwhelming us. For many on the right, illegal immigrants have become an obsession. The party of free enterprise has dedicated itself to a huge buildup of the state's police powers to stop people from working. The Democrats are worried about the wages of employees in the United States, but these fears are now focused on free trade. Though protecting American firms from competition is a sure path to lower productivity, open economic policies are fast losing support within the party. Bill Clinton's historic realignment of his party towards the future, markets, trade, and efficiency, is being squandered in the quest for momentary popularity. Whether on terrorism, trade, immigration, or internationalism of any kind, the political dynamic in the United States these days is to hunker down. Some of foreign policy is what we do, but some of it is also who we are. Hubert Humphrey reputedly said that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was one of the most important foreign policies of that decade. America, the place, has often been the great antidote to U.S. foreign policy. When American actions across the world have seemed harsh, misguided, or unfair, America itself has always been open, welcoming, and tolerant. I remember visiting the United States as a kid in the 1970s, at a time when, as a country, India was officially anti-American. The reality of the America that I experienced was a powerful refutation of the propaganda and caricatures of its enemies. But today, through inattention, fear, and bureaucratic cowardice, the caricature threatens to become reality. At the end of the day, openness is America's greatest strength. Many smart policy wonks have clever ideas that they believe will better American productivity, savings, and healthcare. More power to them all. But historically, America has succeeded not because of the ingenuity of its government programs, but because of the vigor of its society. It has thrived because it has kept itself open to the world, to goods and services, to ideas and inventions, and above all, to people and cultures. This openness has allowed us to respond quickly and flexibly to new economic times, to manage change and diversity with remarkable ease, and to push forward the boundaries of individual freedom and autonomy. It has allowed America to create the first universal nation, a place where people from all over the world can work, mingle, mix, and share in a common dream and a common destiny. In the fall of 1982, I arrived here as an 18-year-old student from India, 8,000 miles away. America was in rough shape. That December, unemployment hit 10.8%, higher than at any point since World War II. Interest rates hovered around 15%. Vietnam, Watergate, the energy crisis, and the Iranian hostage crisis had all battered American confidence. Images of the helicopters on the roof of the American embassy in Saigon, of Nixon resigning, of long lines at gas stations, and of the hostages blindfolded were all fresh in people's minds. The Soviet Union was on a roll, expanding its influence far beyond its borders, from Afghanistan to Angola to Central America. That June, Israel invaded Lebanon, making a volatile situation in the Middle East even more tense. Yet America was a strikingly open and expansive country. Reagan embodied it. Despite record low approval ratings at the time, he exuded optimism from the center of the storm. In the face of Moscow's rising power, he confidently spoke of a mortal crisis in the Soviet system and predicted it would end up on the ash heap of history. Across the political aisle stood Thomas Tip O'Neill, the hearty Irish-American Speaker of the House, who personified the generosity and tolerance of old-school liberalism. Everywhere I went, the atmosphere was warm and welcoming. It was a feeling I had never had before, a country wide open to the world, to the future, and to anyone who loved it. To a young visitor, it seemed to offer unlimited generosity and promise. For America to thrive in this new and challenging era, for it to succeed amid the rise of the rest, it need fulfill only one test. It should be a place that is as inviting and exciting to the young student who enters the country today as it was for this awkward 18-year-old a generation ago.
The Post-American World was written and read by Fareed Zakaria. The recording engineer was Michael Jones. Editing and post-production by Steven Strassman. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Michael Noble. The Post-American World was produced and directed by Carol Shapiro. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.